It's Wednesday, October 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, rescue workers are reaching earthquake victims in remote areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
He has a sort of strong moral center, and he saw Saddam Hussein as a bad man.
A former British prime minister says some mistakes were made during the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Also ahead, Indonesia commits to a massive Pacific trade deal. A Chinese pianist seeks to inspire the next generation. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Rescuers are working to reach remote areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan rocked by Monday's 7.5 magnitude earthquake that has killed more than 360 people and injured more than 2,200 others in both countries. The quake struck sparsely populated areas of northern Afghanistan, and the toll is worst in Pakistan's northwest. Speaking with International Edition host Susan Yaki, reporter Ayaz Gul in Islamabad says people are breathing a sigh of relief because the overall damage does not appear to be quite as bad as in the past.
I was able to travel through four towns that were supposed to be the worst affected areas. As we were expecting on Tuesday morning that with the sunrise, the authorities will be able to determine the exact extent of the damage. But what I have seen in these four areas that there are damages to houses, but they're scattered like maybe one in 10 houses got some damage. But that too was because of heavy rain that was taking place prior to the earthquake. So the good news for the region was that it was a very strong earthquake. But because of the depth of the quake, experts now are saying that the damage that is not visible and that is not there is because the earthquake was really deep, and that is why, especially that mountainous terrain where the earthquake struck, people are really lucky that there was less damage as compared to what was being expected and what Pakistan had witnessed 10 years ago.
I was going to ask you, this area is frequently hit by earthquakes. Was there a chance to fully recover from previous quakes before this latest quake?
Well, there has been criticism because the damage that was caused by the previous quake was so extensive that it took Pakistan a few years with the help of international community to even complete the rescue work because it was really a massive earthquake at that time, and the damage was it covered a vast area that. Where towns after towns were flattened. So that was the worry, that this earthquake had exactly the same magnitude, and people were just so scared from the previous quake that the moment this thing happened, everybody was anticipating and was predicting that it's going to be the same kind of situation when the people wake up next morning.
What about supplies and rescue efforts for those who have been victims of this earthquake, the most recent one? Is there enough?
Yes, obviously, because Pakistan, after the previous earthquake, had put in place certain institutions and mechanisms that it was ready to deal with any calamity. And obviously, the scale of this earthquake is not that big. So there's quite a massive rescue effort taking place. But as I said, the preparedness was good enough to deal with a major disaster. But in this case, authorities have been able to manage so far.
Aid officials do say that getting assistance to all of the quake-stricken areas will take some time. Well, we turn now to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 to bring us the latest buzz online. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
What do you have for us today?
Well, let's take a look at how the presidential hopefuls are preparing for Wednesday's debate. And of course, we start with Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
He's on Twitter at RealDonaldTrump and tweeted this. I am leaving for Sioux City, Iowa. Great event and rally. That's been retweeted almost 600 times and marked as a favorite about 1,500 times.
Well, gee, I know he loves to share his supporters' tweets and poll the results in his favor, of course. Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that today?
Absolutely. Here's one. He shared a link to a PR Newswire article and tweeted, Trump's national lead increases to 35.6% going to the third GOP debate. It's Trump, Carson, and Rubio.
Well, must be nice. So what are the other two tweeting ahead of the big event?
So Ben Carson, who is on Twitter at RealBenCarson, shared a picture of him with UFC fighters. And he tweeted this, a little pre-debate preparation with former hashtag UFC light heavyweight champion Victor Belfort and team. Great sparring partner. But Jim, I don't think he actually sparred with Belfort because even in the photo, he's wearing a suit and a tie.
Ah, did giveaway. What about Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush?
Marco Rubio tweeted this. Tomorrow is the third GOP debate. RT, that means retweet if you're ready for a new American century. And Jeb Bush took a scenic hike with war veterans and shared some photos. Here's what he wrote as a photo caption. The best way to prepare for the GOP debate. A morning hike at El Dorado Canyon State Park with veterans. The Topsy Analytics website shows that hashtag GOP debate was used in more than 2,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. Jim?
Well, thanks for that great update, G. Our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, you can follow her on her very own Twitter account at G. Abby Lee, and also by following our program's account. It's at VOA underscore IE. I'm on there too, at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has apologized for what he calls mistakes made during the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. In an interview with CNN, Blair also cites that military intervention as a trigger for current conflicts in the region, including the rise of Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But Mr. Blair did not fully apologize for the war. For more perspective on Tony Blair's comments, we turn to Laura Beers, associate professor in the Department of History at American University. Professor Beers, Britain and Tony Blair, obviously, were the largest partner in the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq.
Yes, and he gave legitimacy to the invasion in the United States, I think particularly. Many who were ambivalent about going into Iraq saw the support that the British government was giving George W. Bush's administration and their role in the invasion as the kind of crucial decider in getting behind the war.
In his quotes, he said that he could apologize for the fact that the intelligence they received was wrong, even though that Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people and others. That's not what they found when they went in.
I think the thing is that I think that Blair doesn't regret having gone in and having removed Saddam Hussein. I don't think he even particularly regrets that he had to mislead the British people in order to get them to go behind him. I mean, I think he thinks that going into Iraq was the right thing. I think he regrets the fact that he became hugely unpopular as a consequence of the Iraq war. I think he regrets the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction has really tarnished his reputation and has hurt the Labour Party and essentially contributed to keeping Labour out of power for the last decade. So those things I think he regrets, and I think he sort of feels bad that the intelligence, which I don't even know whether or not he believed at the time, has proved inaccurate.
The Prime Minister seemed to have a real conviction about going into Iraq.
to a degree, that was religiously inspired, not in the sense of some sort of holy war, but in the more basic sense of he has a sort of strong moral center, and he saw Saddam Hussein as a bad man. He saw his regime as bad for the people of Iraq, and it, for him it was a very black and white issue that this was a bad leader who it was for the good of the world to have removed from power.
Blair also acknowledged that there were some elements of truth in the view that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was also the principal cause in the rise of ISIS, and that too would have a big political impact at home.
Yes, particularly in that the new leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, is much more hesitant about any kind of involvement, not just Iraq, but in the Middle East more broadly, particularly any American-led efforts at regime change or state building, which he sees as kind of foredoomed to failure and also as sort of modern American imperialism. And so the shift within Tony Blair's own party about what can be achieved in the Middle East by Britain and the United States and what perhaps Britain and the United States should even be thinking about trying to achieve has shifted radically in the last decade. And I think Blair is trying to mend some fences or at least sort of bridge some gaps between him and the party as it now stands.
Just today, Defense Secretary Ash Carter suggested that the United States will be sending troops to Iraq and Afghanistan in the future. Has the Iraq invasion and the aftermath of it and what is being talked about now affected the U.S.-British relationship in the sense that a partnership may be a little bit more difficult to maintain in that arena?
I think there's a lot of suspicion. I mean, we saw it particularly with the question of British support for U.S. airstrikes in Syria, you know, which the House of Commons sort of came out and made a statement that they would not support the government going into Syria, even though the government technically can make its own decisions in terms of executive authority and what they do in Syria. Then there was a sort of, this summer, a big uproar when it became apparent that there were some British troops embedded in exchanges with American troops who were flying sorties over Syria. So there's a lot of anxiety about sort of being sucked into another American-led adventure or misadventure in the Middle East. And though you have some sympathy for America's overseas agenda on the part of the Prime Minister, David Cameron, there's, I think, a lot of suspicion, much of which kind of stems from the feeling that Britain was deceived in Iraq.
Laura Beers, Associate Professor in the Department of History at American University here in Washington, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Britain committed the second largest number of troops to the invasion at 45,000, and they joined nearly 150,000 American soldiers and several thousand more from Australia, Spain, and Poland. Of the British forces, 179 were killed during the conflict. Indonesian President Joko Widodo was on his first state visit to the United States Monday and committed to joining the 12-Nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, Free Trade Agreement of Pacific Rim Countries. That trade pact, recently agreed to but lacking ratification, aims to cut tariffs and streamline trade rules among nations accounting for 40% of the world's economic growth. However, the Indonesian leader faces some stiff opposition at home. Don Emerson, director of the Southeast Asia program at Stanford University, told VOA's Victor Beatty, ironically, the Indonesia leader's endorsement may enhance the chances of passage of TPP in the U.S. Congress.
Symbolically, the statement that Jokowi made does certainly strengthen the momentum on the TPP. The fact that the largest country in Southeast Asia, and a democracy to boot, the fact that its president has expressed support for the TPP might make it easier for the TPP to pass the U.S. Congress. He will run into such flack politically back in Indonesia that they will say, no, this is an effort to export American standards and open up Indonesia to economic penetration by the West, by the United States. There's a public responsibility over the land and water and the resources, in effect, in Indonesia, which implies a kind of semi-socialist regime in which the kinds of entrepreneurship and openings for the private sector that the TPP is in a way all about would be certainly unorthodox and perhaps even anathema. So there will be a backlash, I'm certain. Indonesia's economy is slowing. It's not doing well. There's a general understanding, I believe, certainly among the people who lead the Indonesian economy, both in terms of people in the cabinet, as well as commentators in universities, business people in the private sector. They realize that the steps that Indonesia has recently taken in the last year or so that basically shut down access or reduce access to the Indonesian economy. And to the extent that people in the government recognize that and are willing to use the TPP, here's the critical argument, as an external excuse to engage in domestic reform, it seems to me that the TPP could play that role in which the government could say, look, we want to be part of the world economy. Our economy at home is not doing well. We need to reduce corruption. We need to improve efficiency. And joining the TPP and trying to meet its standards will enable us to engage in economic reform at home that will benefit Indonesia.
Don Emerson, director of the Southeast Asia Program at Stanford University. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Chinese pianist Long Long is known for his virtuosity. He's won multiple awards, has performed with some of the world's top orchestras, and has given concerts in front of millions of people. International Edition's David Byrd reports the Long Long International Music Foundation aims to bring the joy and benefits of music to children worldwide.
The list of Long Long's accomplishments is itself inspiring. Playing at Carnegie Hall, at the 2014 World Cup concert in Rio de Janeiro, at the Grammy Awards twice, and at the opening ceremony of the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, Long Long has dominated piano for more than a decade now. His playing has also started a revival of piano studying in China with the Long Long Music World Arts Complex. But he still remembers how inspired he was by hearing great composers as a small child, and he aims to bring music to the lives of children around the world through the Long Long International Music Foundation.
Now we have a good team to develop a very good method, music education method, and we are giving those methods to selected schools, which we have a partnership with. So first we started two schools, one in Harlem a year ago, and then Boston 2 years ago. We are working with the kids, the children who start to learn music for the first time.
The foundation aims to pass on the excitement and passion for music that Long Long has. The Chinese-born pianist says his foundation offers students digital pianos with their teachers monitoring each student's performance in a classroom setting instead of one-on-one instruction.
At school, you have everybody play. They have a headphone on. So the teachers are almost like a DJ, you know, and multiple channels. Okay, I like to hear piano number 5. Can you play something for me? Now I want to hear piano 6 and 8 to play a duet for me. You know, so in this way, we are bringing music education really like a language training, so people can talk to each other through music.
Long Long started the foundation in 2008. Since then, he has tried to take music education to places it might never have been through partnerships with sponsors and through the help of the Grammys and UNICEF. In 2013, he was chosen to be a United Nations Messenger of Peace. The pianist says he hopes that through music, he can help people cross cultural and social divides.
I mean, music makes me a better person, which, you know, brings me became a citizen of the world and, you know, traveling around the world, making friends all over the world. And, you know, hopefully we're, you know, making the world a better place through music.
Long Long is currently at the end of the U.S. leg of his latest tour. He will play concerts at Washington's Kennedy Center and then travel to France, Switzerland, and Britain by the end of November. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I had the exceptional good fortune to see Long Long at the opening ceremonies of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. That's something I'll never forget. But if you really want something inspirational, maybe you should hook up with our engineer, Jimmy Cook. He plays bass, you know. I'm just throwing it out there, that's all. You can find us at voanews.com. International Edition is also on Twitter at VOA_IE. We hope you follow us. Our director is Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson. We both thank you for joining us, and we hope you have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender-based violence is a scourge from which no country is immune. It is estimated that globally, one out of three women faces violence during her lifetime for no other reason than her gender. As unfortunately commonplace as gender-based violence is under normal circumstances, it increases exponentially during conflict, natural disasters, and other humanitarian emergencies. In emergency situations, societal structures break down, and women and girls in particular face an increased risk of gender-based violence, including sexual exploitation and abuse, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, and trafficking. That is why 2 years ago, representatives of a number of governments, transnational organizations, NGOs, and civil society organizations met in London under the leadership of the United Kingdom to form a call to action on protecting girls and women in emergencies. The United States took on leadership of the call to action in 2014. As a commitment to the call to action, the United States announced its Safe from the Start program, an initiative that aims to address and reduce the incidence of gender-based violence in emergencies. We have used Safe from the Start funding to help our partners assist thousands of displaced Iraqis. Safe from the Start supported training for refugees from the Central African Republic on how to respond to sexual exploitation and abuse, setting up complaint mechanisms and emergency phone lines to report abuses. And in the Congo, we are helping to establish security patrol teams and install solar lights in communities so that women and girls are able to venture outside after sundown. At a ministerial on gender-based violence in humanitarian emergencies, a meeting co-sponsored by the United States and Sweden, Secretary of State John Kerry announced an additional $17 million for Safe from the Start. If we are to be successful in this effort, said Secretary Kerry, we need to take action. We need a zero-tolerance policy toward gender-based violence against anyone, men, women, and children. We must treat the survivors of violence with the sensitivity, respect, and the dignity that they deserve, and we must bring perpetrators to justice. Finally, to be successful, we must all work together. We have learned in painful and searing ways that gender-based violence can rip families apart, rip communities apart, and attack state structures. And too often, in too many countries, it perpetrates conflict and creates instability for generations, said Secretary of State Kerry. Preventing and dealing with the effects of gender-based violence is a fundamental moral issue. It's a basic question of right versus wrong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.